This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
Working with districts, looking for the best way to move forward with local government reorganisation and the unitary conversation and service delivery. And the point is to make Kent residents' lives better. Once we figure that out, then government will look and go, right, you know that. You have a clear steer. You've got a clear vision. You are ready for devolution now. Mm. And that, coming out the end of that, will be better because we'll see the others. They will make mistakes. They will make mistakes. And we should look at this as an opportunity to learn and come out the other side in a better way.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week, Innovation Park Medway finally got a tenant, kind of. Renewed calls were made to sort out a closed down major road, and Kent Highways chief slammed utility companies for causing chaos. I'm Simon Finlay, the local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who reports on Medway Council.
Hello.
And senior news editor Nikki White, who'll be looking at what's going on at Westminster.
Hello.
And later on we'll be hearing from our special guest, Labour's County Councillor for Canterbury, Alistair Brady. First up, Robert, what's been going on in Medway this week?
Well, hot off the news we discussed last week that Innovation Park Medway was getting a rethink, changing the northern part of the site into an industrial and mid-tech focused area, and the southern part into a 70-bed care home with 16 retirement properties. This was agreed this week, formally by the authority's cabinet. But on top of that, it was officially announced that BAE Systems will be the first tenant to take up Innovation Park Medway, agreeing a short-term lease until the end of 2028.
How's that come about then?
Well, the Labour cabinet said this was a result of basically picking up the phone to businesses that they thought were prime candidates to sign on to the site, something they believe that the previous Tory administration just didn't do. They also said the whole rethink of the project and changing its direction was an obvious move as long back as 2019, but that the previous administration, for whatever reason, simply just didn't face up to it. It might also have helped that BAE Systems are now currently investing £220 million in a new state-of-the-art factory at their site in Rochester, which is very close to the Innovation Park Medway site. So the lease is for a temporary car park while the works to build this new facility occur. However, councillors are keen to say this is just the opening of a door to further conversations about how this site might be used in future tenants.
Thanks very much, Robert.
So, Simon, what have you been working on this week?
This week I put together a lengthy explainer on why the whole of Kent seems to be under some form of roadworks all the time and the frustration that this causes the local people. I spoke in detail to Neil Baker, who is Kent County Council's Highways Chief and is responsible for the maintenance of the county's some 5,400 miles of road, which is a huge undertaking. And I also interviewed Sean Holden, who's the Chairman of the Transport Committee at KCC, who is not short of opinions.
So what have you specifically been looking at?
Well, the main thrust is the fact that neither Councillor Baker nor Councillor Sean Holden or anyone else at KCC, for that matter, has actually got any real power to control the number of roadworks in Kent. A large proportion of the work is in KCC repairing potholes and general repairs and maintenance, which has obviously increased in the past few years because of house building and other factors. But KCC has the ability to regulate and plan for those works it carries out, but it can't really do anything or deny any other body, such as a utility company or a broadband provider, from digging up the roads. So KCC has to grant the temporary road closures, but there's no real choice in how they do that. So much of what is happening to Kent's roads is because of house building, generally speaking.
What about emergency closures?
Well, that's the greyest of the grey areas. And Casey thinks that the use of emergency permits is being exploited. Essentially, a utility company can go to KCC and they need to shut a road for an emergency repair, say it's a gas leak or whatever. And this can be done with 2 hours' notice, which is nothing in terms of alerting motorists or local residents about what's happening. But what really annoys people is that these emergency closures are put in place and then nothing actually happens for several days. And it really, really grinds people's gears.
So what can be done?
Well, Councillor Baker thinks that the Highways Act, which is the legislation, needs to be amended in such a way that flowing traffic is treated as more important than the works themselves. The fines for breaching the permit conditions need to be hiked massively, and large projects should be charged the rentals by the day. Neil and Sean have some really interesting things to check out, so give it a read. What's been happening in Westminster, Nikki?
So this week, I'm asking you to cast your mind back to the day when a major road in Swanscombe collapsed after a landslide. It's hard to believe, but next month it will be 2 years since Galley Hill Road, which is the stretch of road which runs between Swanscombe High Street and Ebbsfleet Football Club. It's 2 years since it was shut after a cliff collapsed. Since then, the area has faced huge disruption, particularly with traffic as vehicles, including large lorries, are diverted through narrow residential streets, which simply aren't suitable for that kind of thing. Businesses too have been feeling the brunt as customers struggle to get to them. So there's been a lot of delay, but a lot of that has been caused by legal wrangling between the Highways Authority, which is KCC, the utility company Thames Water, and the landowners. And it was a year before investigators even got access to the full site to see what the issues are. So back in September, a contractor for KCC was carrying out investigations on the cliff face, and that was to help identify the cause of the landslide and also establish the condition of the cliff as it is now in a bid to come up with some options over new road designs. That information from the surveys is now being assessed, but here we are 2 years on and the route is still shut.
Okay, so what's happening now then?
Well, this week, Dartford MP Jim Dixon, he's written to the Transport Secretary Heidi Alexander, and he's asked her for an urgent meeting to discuss the need for the government to step in and fund a solution. Mr Dixon has said the situation is simply not good enough, and residents who live in Swanscombe and Greenhithe should not still be in this situation 2 years down the line. Now, when he was elected last July, Mr Dixon said opening Galley Hill Road was one of his main priorities, and he has made it one. He's regularly raised the issue with ministers and officials for something to be done. For example, he's asked several parliamentary questions, and last September, along with his counterpart Gravesham MP Dr Lauren Sullivan, they welcomed Roads Minister Lillian Greenwood to the area so she could see for herself the huge problems everyone's facing. Mr Dixon says he's been in regular dialogue with KCC. It falls under their remit as the Highways Authority. It just wants to get things going, and KCC has now put forward a case to the government. Mr Dixon's letter backs that plea, and he says that given that we now finally have a way forward, it's absolutely critical that the government and KCC work closely to get both the plans and the funding in place so that the work can get started as soon as possible. On top of that, there's a public meeting on March the 21st where Mr Dixon will update people on what's going on, and it will also be a chance for people to reiterate their ongoing concerns. Now, given how long this is taking, it's going to be a lively meeting as people share their frustrations over what seems like a never-ending nightmare.
Okay, thank you, Nikki.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Alistair Brady is one of the bright young things of Kent Labour politics, leader of the Labour group at Kent County Council and a member of Canterbury City Council, and by all accounts, a pretty nice guy. Alistair, welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Simon, and thanks for saying I'm a pretty nice guy.
That's what everybody says. Before we get into the many things that we need to talk to you about, tell us a little bit about your background and what sparked your interest in politics.
Sure. I was born in Dover in 76, slowly moved to the north of Kent through Whitfield, Shepherdswell, and then moved into Canterbury in the 80s. I moved into a house that's in the division that I represent, and my mum still lives in that house. And yeah, growing up, I had a couple of medical issues at age 14 and 15. My lung collapsed 3 times when I was in and out of hospital and had a major operation. I know. But I mean, you just get on with it, don't you? I still play sport, played squash for Canterbury football teams. But from then, after school, I wanted to travel, but I wanted to do it cheaply. And I thought one way to do that and maybe get paid for it and do it for free, I became an air steward. And so through that, I saw loads of places around the world, learned to scuba dive. But during that...
Which airline was it?
I started at Britannia Airways, and then Britannia morphed into Thomson Airways, TUI Airways. They all changed their names. But from that, I didn't really study politics early on. I would just watch it from afar. And through watching television and through the austerity years, I was just really frustrated with what was going on. Not just nationally, but locally, things didn't seem to be improving. So I wanted to see what I could do, if I could do something to do something locally.
Mm. Did you come from a sort of a political family, you know, that was interested in politics?
No, not really. It was a don't talk about religion and politics. And I think that was one of the main problems that society has, because for 40, 50 and 30 year olds, there was the don't talk about religion and politics at the dinner table, but it should have been talk about it to learn how to disagree well. Mm-hmm. But I didn't come from a very political background. And that's why 8 years ago, I went part-time at work, and I went back into academia as a mature student. So I went back to college to study humanities, and I was lucky enough to get a distinction at the end. And then I went to the University of Kent to study philosophy and politics, and I ended up with a first class honours degree. Mm-hmm. And I was writing my dissertation whilst I was campaigning to be a county councillor. So it was, and my partner was pregnant with a little boy. So it was a really busy time 4 years ago.
Yeah, but it was, yeah. So, I mean, was there any particular person that you remember, you know, proved to be something of an inspiration to you?
Well, I think I grew up through the Blair years towards the end, and that's when I really first saw the difference between political parties. There is a clear distinction. Obviously, naturally, I'm going to say that the party that I stand for stands up for communities, local people and working people. So it would have been when you always hear the Gordon Brown speech of what the Labour Party has done. And that just gives me tingles when he just reels off all the amazing things that we did in government with a roaring background of approval behind him. So, yeah, it's the inspiration is leaders that made a difference, really. And I think through those years, we were able to make a difference, a positive difference for our country.
Mm. And why Labour?
I see us as the party that stands up for the majority of the people in our country and locally. We have great environmental credentials. We look after the welfare of residents and constituents. It's about supporting people locally instead of supporting institutions. Mm-hmm. Looking at somebody and valuing that person instead of looking at an institution and how these people can then fit into that institution. Well, I believe other ideologies focus on that institution and how that can better people's lives, but I want to focus on that person. People can do so many good things, and we just need to tap into that and help those people do that.
You worked for the former Labour MP, who's now sits as an independent, Rosie Duffield. Why did you leave your job there?
As the leader of the Kent Labour Group, I didn't think I was able to work in an MP's office, not from my political party. I think it's pretty clear if you are within a political party and you have a leading role there, to be able to have a clear distinction. But that's the only reason I decided, and I was fortunate enough to work in Rose's office as a caseworker, because that's another extension of how to help people at city level. You're able to help people with planning issues and local issues in Canterbury. At county level, it's still local issues, but you're looking at children, young people, education, adult social care, transport. And then that was another level. It was another level in working in an MP's office to be able to support people through casework.
It's a busy old job, a caseworker in an MP's office, particularly for any kind of deprived area. I mean, they're literally bombarded with hundreds of emails every day. It must have been...
It is. And I only worked on Friday, so I'd pick up most of the KCC casework from there, because then I was able to go to offices to try and solve problems there. Being a counsellor, you can be as busy or not as you want. And I wanted to do it properly. So I was able to do this full time. When I eventually took, after university, I took, during university, I took redundancy from my role. So then I was able to become a counsellor full time and focus on that for a couple of years. It was a struggle. And I think we really need to be able to reflect Kent residents as a whole within KCC. And I think the problem that we have is the workload. And then people then having a job alongside that, we need to make that easier, because then we need to get a reflection of Kent as a whole and Kent residents, and KCC would be from that better for it.
Do you think KCC is reflective of Kent as it is today?
No. I mean, if you look at the demographic within KCC, it's not. It's getting easier, getting better. There are ways to be able to help councillors be able to do that job well and have a full-time job. But 4 years ago when I came in, and I think the term before that, if you look at the demographic within KCC, it's not reflective, is it?
I mean, the big news in Kent in the last couple of months has been devolution and local government reform. I mean, where did you stand as a group on that?
Yeah, as a group, we made our position very clear. We wanted the elections to go ahead, and we wanted to prioritise local government reorganisation, not because we didn't see the benefits of devolution and mayoral strategic authority. There are benefits. There'll be more devolved powers from government and more money. But if you don't get local government reorganisation right, working alongside the devolution conversation, then it's an afterthought. And a local government reorganisation, and then when I say that, I'm talking about unitaries. Mm-hmm. It just gives a clearer steer and a clearer picture of what service delivery will look like in Kent. And that's what's necessary.
I mean, the Tory leader at KCC, Roger Gough, and the Labour leader of Medway, Vince Maple, I mean, they united in trying to get the whole of Kent into the first tranche of the devolution priority programme and failed. But didn't you feel that you were sort of slightly out of step with Vince Maple?
No. Vince and I get on really well. It's really, and we didn't really have a huge differing of opinion. My opinion is getting it right instead of right now. And it doesn't matter if we're not on the devolution priority program, which just simply means that there would have been elections in 26. There's nothing to say that we can't learn from the councils around us who are doing that in 26. And then 27, 28, we could be on that path. We've seen what mistakes they've made. We've compensated for them. And we come out of that so much better.
Yeah. I mean, why do you think that Kent failed to make it into that first tranche? I mean, we know the official reasons that there's a differential between the sort of population sizes, the sizes of the councils that we've just been talking about, KCC and Medway. Does that ring true to you?
Maybe it's because Kent wasn't ready. Maybe it's because of local government reorganisation needs to be seen as a priority to get that right to then move to devolution. I don't see the others do, because when you speak to the leader of KCC, he keeps mentioning it in a negative, but I think you don't look backwards. Let's look forwards. Let's find the positives, because the destination, we know where we're going to be.
Mm. Yeah, the white paper makes it very clear that everyone's going to be basically have a mayor and have unitary authorities underneath it.
So the destination is clear. It's getting the journey right. And I think that's the main thing now. The decision's been made. We can go over a million and one reasons why we think or assume why that didn't happen, or we can look to see what's next. So what is next is reaching out to residents, parishes, town councils, working with districts, looking for the best way to move forward with local government reorganisation and the unitary conversation and service delivery. And the point is to make Kent residents' lives better. Once we figure that out, then government will look and go, right, you know that. You have a clear steer. You've got a clear vision. You are ready for devolution now. Mm. And that, coming out the end of that, will be better, because we'll see the others. They will make mistakes. They will make mistakes. And we should look at this as an opportunity to learn and come out the other side in a better way.
Okay. I mean, the failure for Kent to get on that priority, the fast track to devolution, obviously means that the Kent elections are on May the 1st. Do you think the Tories became devolution fans just to avoid the election?
No, I think it was helpful. I don't think they were majorly focused on devolution to avoid the election. However, there was a very strong argument to have devolution still have the elections, and I think the conversation did take over slightly because there wasn't a strong enough argument from the Conservatives. They didn't say that we really, really value democracy, but this is one of the things that has to happen. It was convenient. And with elections, they are very clear ways of being tested by your residents on how well you've done your job, not just as a councillor, but as a county council, as an administration. It's a clear test, and it's saying, have we done well enough? Would you like to vote for us again? Should we be carrying on in this role? And it's fortunate that now that question is being asked. Yeah. I think it's uncomfortable because the Conservatives were very wedded to cancelling those elections, but they could have very easily put forward an argument to still have the elections.
Do you think at the end of the day, the government just thought that Kent wasn't ready? That's your theory?
We're getting hung up on a year's delay. I think having local government reorganisation and devolution running concurrently, without devolution and mayoral strategic authority being the prime factor, I think the way that we're doing it, that's the best way. It's all about service delivery. I've just mentioned this. It's all about service delivery and how we are delivering services for our residents and the best way to do that in the most efficient manner. And if through local government reorganisation, that is the priority, that's the focus, where devolution is looking at the strategic vision throughout all of Kent. Well, shouldn't that be concurrent? Shouldn't that vision also feed in to how we deliver services, and how we deliver services feed into that vision? And if you prioritise one over the other, then that's slightly offset. But others chose that path, and the government viewed that the right path for them. Mm. But fortunately, I think this is the right path for Kent to get service delivery right, and concurrently working on proposals on what devolution and a mayoral strategic authority, what that looks like and how that fits within our service delivery.
Do you think Labour can take control at County Hall?
I hope so. I'm going to be working with some really, really great candidates throughout Kent to do that. We've got, you've seen for the last 4 years with our alternative budgets, how we identify problems and issues, and we've, through our alternative budgets, looks for solutions. I don't think any other party has been able to do that, because it's very easy to focus on a problem, but then finding a solution and to be able to cost that in a balanced budget, that's, we've learned that skill over 4 years. We've honed that. And I said that at the last full council, mentioning how the Conservatives have wasted so much money over the last 27 years. It's true. There's a managed decline in roads, there's a managed decline in buildings. You don't get to where you are without looking back and going, okay, then our decisions have got us here. We're ready to be able to make those decisions in County Hall to make the county better.
I mean, there is a not inconsiderable threat to Labour and the Tories from Reform UK. Why do you think they've become so successful in such a short time?
It could be an alternative. However, if you don't have, it's very, like I said, it's very easy to go, that's the problem. We all know where the problems are. Mm. It is harder to be able to come up with solutions and cost those solutions to be able to then move on to the next stage to go, that's the problem, that's how we will fix it. And that's how you convince people locally that you can do that. And we've got some really good, not just really good candidates, but part of our group, everybody has worked incredibly hard, not just internally within the committees, but also in their communities. And through that, we represent what we can do and when we're decision makers.
Mm, okay. What sort of politician would you describe yourself as?
Well, you said a nice guy, but I'll go further. Yeah. I'll go further than that. I came into this trying to move decision making away from Maidstone and give local residents a voice. So I did that by looking at highways. So usually parish councils, who are fantastic, have highways improvement plans. I don't have a parish council in my division. We've got residents associations, but the council didn't look at residents associations in the same vein as parish councils. So we didn't have a highways improvement plan. So what would usually happen, there would be highways improvements that would have to be drip fed through emails from people in my division. So we built with residents these highways improvement plans, taken them to KCC. And through that, we've got a pedestrian crossing outside Archbishop School. Two residents associations wanted to expand the 20 MPH zone. That should be coming in next month. And we've just, in the rain today, I've just out with a couple of residents at another pedestrian crossing. And it's just getting people's views. So it's giving people a voice in Maidstone. And that's not always easy. There were two options for the position of this zebra crossing, and not everybody chose one option. So it's them bringing those people together to try and find, to mitigate, to try and find the best solution. So consulting isn't always easy, but getting to the right destination isn't always an easy path. So as a politician, to ask your question, I think hopefully I'm approachable and I'm hardworking. Okay. Oh, well, I know I'm tired and always busy, so I know I'm hardworking.
Yeah, sure.
That's not because I've just got a toddler.
You are very well thought of at County Hall from all sides. And do you have any ambitions in following not only your old boss, but your predecessor at KCC, Dr. Lauren Sullivan, who became an MP in July?
Nobody can say no to anything, because if I said no, I wouldn't like to be an MP in this interview, and X amount of years down the line, that gets played back to me, then I'll be viewed as dishonest. If we're talking about a mayoral strategic authority, and if deputy or mayor or anything like that is in the horizon, I said, oh no, then that will get played back to me. So you should never, nobody should ever say no. And the whole point of why people get into politics, you hope, is that they can help people. And what better way to help people than try and helping the most number of people. So I'd never say no to anything politically.
Okay, Alistair, listen, thanks a million for taking the time to speak to us. Good luck, and I hope we speak to you again soon.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, now it's time for a moan. Why, oh why, does everything take so long to get done? As we hurtle towards the two-year anniversary of the landslip at Galley Hill Road, which Nicky was mentioning earlier, and it still hasn't been fixed. Just another example of things not getting done. Joining the Why Oh Why Moanathon is KM editor Matt Ramsden. Matt, why oh why does everything take so long?
God knows is the answer, Simon. It's become a bit of a standing joke in the newsroom that I moan about this all the time. And Galley Hill is just one example. I mean, add to that Lower Thames Crossing, HS2, Crossrail, which was finally done but years late. There's just so much in Britain these days which just takes an age to complete, and always comes in billions of pounds over budget. It's unbelievable.
Joking aside, is there any actual reason why these things take so long to do?
We had a guest on the podcast who I was speaking to afterwards, an off the record chat, and he was from the building industry in his professional life. And I asked this question because it just baffles me. And he said that the honest truth, as far as he's concerned, is a whole industry has grown up in Britain, which is built around not doing things. Mm. So it's in the interest of certain businesses like lawyers and environmentalists and so on.
Yeah,
all of those people, it's in their interest that things drag on and on and on. And you
look at all the time, the price goes up.
The price goes up. I mean, the two things I'll mention, Lower Thames Crossing, I think they spent £1 billion on that now, a spade yet to go in the ground. Denmark built a similar crossing, similar scale, £200 million. There's cars driving through it as we speak. It's just unbelievable. The other one that gets my go is Parliament. I mean, behind the scenes, Parliament's a bit of a dump for those that have been
falling
been
to pieces,
there.
Isn't it?
It is falling to pieces. It's a really old building. It hasn't been very well maintained. But when they first started talking about doing it up, it's £1 billion. Latest bid is £22 billion. And you just think, how has that happened? You know, how do you go from £1 billion to £22 billion, and still nothing's happened? Mm. I mean, it just boggles the mind. I mean,
so what would your solution be like that?
With Parliament, I wouldn't refurb. I'd knock it down, or I'd sell it off. Yeah. Honest to God, I would move out of that Parliament. If it's a case to spend £22 million, selling the land for £1 billion and building a new Parliament in Sheffield or Nottingham or Doncaster or Leeds, I'd do that without a doubt.
Mm. Okay. Well, I mean, there are plenty of examples to choose from. I mean, my own personal bugbear is the A249 roundabout at near Bearstead at Grove Green. And about sort of 8 years ago, they put some temporary traffic lights with a view to starting the work. 6 years later, they still hadn't started the work. And when they eventually did start the work, the cost of materials and labour and all the rest of it had shot up so much that the money they'd set aside for it had was completely insufficient to finish the work. So he just abandoned the work that already started. So here you go, same temporary roundabout, sorry, same temporary traffic lights on a roundabout and a half-built roundabout lane on the side. It's just absolutely crazy. And the other one I always think, always makes me laugh, is the A303 in Wiltshire. That's where I do my fishing and often go down that bit that goes past Stonehenge. Everybody knows it goes from a dual carriageway, a single track, and they've been moaning and arguing about this for about 50 years, if not longer, about whether they should widen it or not. Yeah, Nikki, what's your personal moan bugbear?
My moan or bugbear?
I mean, you've been covering that Gravesham area for a number of years.
Many years, yeah. I mean, I partly agree with Matt. It's wise too, because he's my boss. But yes and no. I mean, as you say, I've been covering Gravesham and Dartford for quite some time, and it does feel that, you know, year after year, front pages keep popping up, and it's always the same thing. Next update on the Lower Thames Crossing, next update on the London Resort, and now we are next update on Galley Hill Road. It's years and years in the making, and I do get that these things need investigating, and there are no doubt things going on behind the scenes that we don't know about. I mean, we know... Well, I don't know, I like to think so. I mean, KCC put up a sign at the Cold Harbour roundabout roadworks. Cold Harbour roundabout? Or the No, 8028 on Castle Way. There's recently been some gas works going on there, and they put up one of these LED boards which said, "You may not see us working, but we're working overnight." And I thought that was actually quite clever, because day after day I'd been stuck in traffic jams on this stretch of road, cones everywhere, lanes all coned off, traffic was going nowhere, and you couldn't see anybody doing anything, certainly not while I was there. But knowing that there's work going on now, okay, things like the Lower Thames Crossing, I mean, like London Resort has kind of been resolved without anything actually happening all these years later. We get that boxes need ticking. We get that things that need to be investigated. There are going to be things going on that are going to be a lengthy process of investigation. They need to happen. I mean, we don't want to have a fast fix bodge job for the sake of things happening quickly. They need to be done right. But you do feel that sometimes things are just dragging on too much, and you see roads that have collapsed because of an earthquake somewhere in Asia, and they've been rebuilt within a fortnight, and here we are several years on and we haven't even decided what's going to go where. But yeah, it's frustrating.
Yeah, a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, because we live in a democracy, you know, everybody gets a fair shot, and you know, there are a lot of environmental or ecological reasons for sticking your oar into something and can't drag it on, you know, for years and years and years just because of some bats or newts or whatever. Rob, you're fairly new to Kent, but I mean, what's been getting your goat?
Well, I mean, the thing that immediately springs to mind, I'm afraid, is not Kent related, but you know, I used to live in Manchester, and HS2 was, you know, I don't know how, that was Gordon Brown's idea, and it's not going to happen anymore. At least it's not going to Manchester anymore. I think one group of people we haven't actually mentioned yet, which I think is quite a significant one, are politicians. Things that spring to mind is Nick Clegg, when Russia invaded Ukraine, all of a sudden energy prices started to spike. A clip of Nick Clegg from 10 years previously started doing the rounds again about how he's saying it was ridiculous to invest in nuclear power because it won't come online for another 10 years. Well, when energy prices are suddenly skyrocketing and it'd be good to have our own supply of energy, would have been quite useful at that point. Mm. And I think that sort of expediency, it's politically, you know, comfortable to be on the side of, sometimes to be on the side of the builders, but sometimes on the blockers. I mean, the third runway at Heathrow is a good example of that. Plenty of people were on the side of, we should not have this, and be on the side of the local residents who said it was going to be too loud and noisy. And now some of those people have flipped to the other side, depending on who's in charge and this sort of thing. I think, funnily enough, in preparation for this discussion, I did do a little bit of research in which I Googled...
That'll be a first.
I Googled, why is Britain so bad at, and it fills to building infrastructure. And one of the suggestions was basically, we see these spiraling costs and they go up and up. And it says it's related to politicians in that we underestimate the costs. You know, there are lots of elements of consultation. There are elements of sort of mitigation in terms of, as you mentioned, bat tunnels and things like that, which, you know, when you're trying to pitch this to the public and you're trying to say, we're going to build this brand new bridge or this brand new tunnel, you don't really mention that, because then it sounds really, really expensive instead of it being, you know, quite expensive. And I think I agree with Nikki on the sense of, a lot of these things that hold up these these developments are quite reasonable. I think, you know, you've got to give people the opportunity to say, this isn't going to work for me. You're going to demolish, you know, this wildlife reserve, or you're going to ruin our town, or whatever it is. The problem is when those things become abused because somebody just doesn't like it, it's not really actually going to have a detrimental effect. It's just they don't really want a bypass or, you know, whatever it is, but they can use these tools to abuse them and basically stop anything getting done for the greater good.
Okay, thank you very much, Robert. Okay, folks, that's it for this week's episode. Next week, we'll be speaking to the Weald of Kent MP, Katie Lamb, who will be speaking about working in Downing Street as the pandemic took hold 5 years ago. That will be a good listen. Thanks to Rob, Nikki, and also to Matt for their contributions. Don't forget to keep an eye on kentonline.com/politics for the latest news from across the county. You can also sign up for our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.